Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hi everyone, Harry Robinson here. Before this episode begins, two quick things. Number one, while Jack's sound is crystal clear on this episode, a baffling and unknown error has affected mine. It's not too bad, it just sounds a little more like when we first started recording 8 or 9 years ago, so sorry about that. Maybe you won't notice, but I did, and wanted to explain why. Back to normal for the next episode, the second part of this Patreon mailbag doubleheader, but hopefully it'll be all right and you'll enjoy this one. Second, while I'm here, I thought I might as well give a shout out to the project that's been consuming my life for these last few years, which is a book. I did mention it briefly a couple of weeks ago, but I should probably talk about it a bit more as publication date is coming up on the 25th of September. The Men Who Made Manchester United is the fascinating, I think, oft forgotten story of how youth, courage and success came to define England's biggest football club before Busby, Best, Charlton, Ferguson, Cantona, Beckham or Ronaldo. Read it and you will discover how Manchester United got its name and its colours via a steak-munching, tongue-out St. Bernard dog, a knocked-out cycling accountant and a poisoned beer crisis. You'll discover the in-depth story of United's first successful team, two-time champions and FA Cup winners, including their first European tour on which they were chased out of Budapest by stone-throwing hooligans. You'll read about the inspiration and planning behind United's move to the iconic Old Trafford Stadium. You'll discover the lives, the characters and the motivations of United's first great manager, first great player and first great captain. You'll read about why, how and when the club's world famous academy was set up, the founding and survival of the Professional Footballers Association, how it was defined by United's outcast stars. You'll discover how Matt Busby was set up for success by the determined two steps at a time football fanatic Walter Krickmer, who almost single-handedly dragged United through a six-year global war. And included in all are the themes of trade unionism, industrialisation, the railways, public school masculinity, European nationalism and feminism. All of this framing the early story of English football at Manchester United. Out on the 25th of September, available to pre-order on Waterstones, Amazon, wherever you get your books, maybe in some local bookstores once it comes out as well, with Pitch Publishing. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, you might like to try it. If you do, I really hope you'll enjoy it. It's been fun to write. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. It's the international break, so we're relaxed. No United to worry about. A cup of tea in hand. Or, actually, the club might have another abuse scandal to contend with. They might have invited a convicted paedophile to a game and are dealing with a major player-manager spat. Anyway, it's time to forget about all of that, or most of it, because we're having a patron mailbag episode. Our patrons who've supported us over the last couple of years, 3 years actually, and helped make this podcast possible every week, have sent in some great questions to guide these next one or two episodes over the international break. So I'll just get stuck straight in. There'll be a bit of stuff on United's kind of current form, United's current players. There'll be a bit of stuff on our support of Man United. There'll be a bit of stuff on other football and some personal things as well. So let's see how it goes. And we're going to start with a question from Havard, who's been a patron since March 2021. And his question is, well, it starts with a statement. It turns into a question, Jack. Amrabat was so good during the World Cup. If, and it's a big if he turns out to be that good with us and fits in perfectly with the team in a best case scenario, do you think our central midfield can transform to become one of our best assets? Maybe this is exactly what Casemiro needs to get back to the intensity level he had in the beginning.
I think he would make a big difference if he's as good as we hope. I guess the tricky thing is figuring out whether Casemiro's poor start to this season has been down to just a couple of bad games, which we saw him have at the start of last season, if you go back to his first few appearances for United, or whether it's down to Casemiro aging and his legs being gone, which at, you know, 31 is he now, I think, or 30, yeah, after playing 10 years pretty much of, you know, top level football, playing 50, 60 games a season, is not out of the question. I think whether the answer to that question is it's just a bit of bad form or he's on a permanent decline sort of changes things. Because if Amrabat comes in and can be an addition to Casemiro, then I think we're looking good. If Amrabat comes in and has to directly replace Casemiro, we're basically in the exact same situation we were a month ago, where we're like, okay, we've got one good six, but what if they get injured?
Yeah. I did enjoy reading the opinions of Don Hutchinson, the ex-footballer who covers Serie A quite a lot, who was basically saying everyone in England seems a bit mistaken over the kind of player that Amrabat is. United aren't getting some kind of destroyer or hard tackler. United are getting a near complete midfielder who can do whatever you ask of him and can tackle, but also has great technique and vision. And no one's suggesting that Amrabat's the best midfielder in the world or will be the Premier League's best midfielder, but United are getting a really well-rounded midfielder here. And how much of Morocco did he watch at the World Cup? Do you remember his performances?
Yeah, I remember quite a lot of it. And I mean, in that Morocco team, mainly because of the way that they played, especially in the knockouts, it was that sort of destroyer side of his game that really shone through. But that was mainly because Morocco were a team that were having, you know, 35% possession in a lot of games, playing against some really top teams. But then if, you know, I read that same article from Don Hutchinson, some others as well, that mentioned that Fiorentina had, I'm pretty sure, the second highest share of possession in Serie A last season. And so Amrabat can clearly shine in both a possession-heavy and a really possession-not-heavy team, which I think, you know, says a lot about that Don Hutchinson's point that, you know, Amrabat is a midfielder that can play different roles in different teams and can adapt to what you need him to be. No, go on.
Sorry, I was just going to say, when we last recorded after the Arsenal game, I can't remember if it was in the Patreon Q&A or in the main show, but we were talking about the midfield's problems, and I think it was in the Patreon Q&A, but we're basically talking about the future of the midfield and whether we think it's quite right at the moment. And we were saying that there are good players there, but at the moment it doesn't have the right balance to it. So presumably Amrabat will be really key to that balance, because opposition dependent, he can kind of be the connecting tissue between, say, Casemiro and Fernandes, or Casemiro and Mount, depending on who we're playing.
And he brings a lot more mobility to that midfield as well. You know, if he's obviously not going to play as a number 10, so he's really going to come in and play as either alongside Casemiro or replace Casemiro. And if the two that he's really going to be replacing there would be Casemiro or Eriksen, it could be Mount as well. But if Mount does play, he's likely to play further forward than Eriksen, even though they'd on paper be in the same role. He offers much more mobility than either Casemiro or Eriksen. And so you would hope that by doing that, Amrabat would allow us to be a more dominant team, because you can trust that he would be able to cover a lot more ground as we push men forward. I think one of the issues with Casemiro, it always has been, but especially at the start of this year, is that even in parts of games where we are quite dominant, if the ball breaks and we end up having to defend a counter-attack, Casemiro just can't cover the ground to properly defend it. He ends up having to dive in, and that's why he was picking up so many bookings in the second half of last season. You know, if Amrabat can come in and just provide a little bit more protection as someone that can just defend a lot more space, that in itself is going to be a really valuable asset.
But how does it work then? Because at the start of this season, it was Casemiro and Mount Fernandes. Where does Amrabat fit? Well, it's not where does he fit. Who comes out?
Yeah.
Well, as it stands, United are losing wingers every day, so perhaps Fernandes will be playing on
the
right wing.
Initially, he probably gets brought in as a Casemiro replacement at 60 or 70 minutes.
Right.
I think we will probably see him start quite a few games alongside Casemiro. But I think as the season wears on, it's going to be a big puzzle for Ten Hag to figure out, because we now have in Fernandes, Mount, Eriksen, Amrabat. Let's assume that Casemiro is still going to be one of the first names on the team sheet. I could see Amrabat playing instead of Casemiro occasionally, but I don't think that's going to be the norm. So if we assume that Casemiro is going to generally be the one to play as our defensive midfielder, you've then got those other four to fit into two positions.
Yeah.
And really it's sort of three and one, because we know that Fernandes is going to play as a number 10 in almost every game. Now, there's two ways you can look at that. One is that you could say, well, it's good because all three of those are different profiles and offer something different, which is true. Eriksen, much more suited at being that sort of deep-lying playmaker.
It's more the Man City model. But what City have is, last season, for example, you knew Rodri was playing
every time, and that was your reliable bit. And Casemiro is obviously that in terms of quality, but it doesn't seem that way right now. What's interesting with Casemiro is it feels to me, I don't know whether you'll agree, that he's quite he's a player that requires his rhythm, because when he came into the United side in October, really, of 2022, it took quite a while for him to get going. When he came back from his 3 and 4 game suspensions, it took him a little while to get going. So it's not like you're going to be looking to rest him on the bench too much. I think it's more what you're saying in terms of 60 minutes onwards, where you hope to keep him fresh for kind of an hour in each game. But, and that's possible with 5 substitutions. But do you see it similarly?
I think initially it will be. I think there is a chance that if Amrabat comes in and plays really well in those cameos, and I'm sure he'll get more minutes as, you know, the games ramp up, as Champions League starts and the League Cup starts, I think we could see him play alongside Casemiro more.
Yeah.
But I don't see him and Casemiro rotating, you know, one starts 50% of the games and the other starts the other 50%.
Yeah.
I don't see that happening. I still think it's more as rotation within games, but then also I think Amrabat could come in and start alongside
him,
which I don't have a problem with.
He's fantastically bald as well. I enjoyed his signing photos. All I could think about was, because there was one where he was pointing to his name on the back of his shirt, and I'm in the nerdy way that adults shouldn't really have, but I'm delighted he's got 4, proper midfielder's number. He's pointing to the name on his back of his shirt. I just thought, God, he's bald. So hopefully that's a good sign. I've got a quiz question for you as well.
All right.
On Amrabat. We're not playing Guess the Player this week because it's not the normal episode, but here's your quiz question. Amrabat of Morocco and Bayern Deer of Turkey will be the first players from their respective countries to represent Manchester United. Morocco and Turkey will be the 48th and 49th nations to have supplied a player to United. So my question this week is, outside of the United Kingdom and Republic of Ireland, from which country have United had the most players?
Good question.
I'll leave that question hanging for a bit. Don't give me an answer yet. If you don't have an answer after the next couple of kind of patron questions, I'll give you 3 multiple choice options.
All right.
And then we'll come to the answer later on in the show.
Okay.
So, as a reminder, in short, outside of the UK and Ireland, from which country have United had the most players? Yeah, I'll get your thoughts on that shortly. But let's have a question from Tony Ryan, who's been a patron for about a year now, since September 2022. He says, given all the heavy end things that are going on at the moment, something lighter and for a bit of fun, predict the scores in each of our 6 Champions League game, please, gentlemen. So, Bayern Munich away. Let's go straight in there. I'm going a 3-1 loss.
Oh, United are winning away at Bayern. 2-1.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why?
I have a weird feeling. We've had a history in recent years of playing very well and our, on paper, most difficult away game in European groups. Go back to beating Juventus, beating PSG. I don't know why. I have a strange feeling that we're going to do a proper smash and grab at the Allianz and then get rolled at Old Trafford.
Okay. Well, you've ruined the 6th game prediction already. But yeah, I'd be delighted with that. Yeah. The trip to Munich is a proper bucket list thing. Me and my brother have booked Tuesday to Friday. It's timed at the same time as Oktoberfest, which has created all sorts of problems for United fans in terms of expense. Flights more expensive. The accommodation is absolutely nuts. So me and my brother, and I'll tell you more about this after, are staying. Hopefully this is a real place. We found on Airbnb a shepherd's hut, which is in a field, basically, on the outskirts of Munich. And it is a shepherd's hut with a couple of beds, a sink, a shower. The toilet is separate. You have to walk outside and a load of sheep around. So it's going to be one of the more unique ways. But Oktoberfest Tuesday night, then roll into our shepherd's hut. United on Wednesday. We're both staying because we've got a bit of remote work to do on the Thursday, and then see Munich a bit on the Friday and head home. So, yeah. Anyway, that's a serious deviation. So I'm going 3-1 loss at Bayern, although Jack's convinced me a bit here. Did you say 2-1 win?
Yeah.
Okay, Galatasaray at home. 2-1 United.
1-0 United.
Yeah. There's a bit of me inside that are thinking maybe a draw, but I'm not going to say it. Copenhagen away on the 8th of November. 2-1 United. Tough, but we'll win. And we need to win there because I don't think we'll win at Bayern or Galatasaray.
3-1 United.
Nice, confident. Galatasaray away. 1-1. And that's optimistic.
1-0 Galatasaray.
Yeah, that's probably more realistic. And Bayern Munich at home.
3-1 Bayern.
Wow, that'd be painful. Imagine, because that final game, I tell you what, it should be in the Champions League this year.
Wait, did we miss one out there? Did we miss out Copenhagen at home?
It does feel like we did that, doesn't it?
I don't think we did Copenhagen at home. 2-0 United.
Yeah, 3-0 United. Rasmus Højlund could come up against both of his brothers in that game. He's unlikely for all three of them to play, but his two brothers play for Copenhagen. I've been to Copenhagen Stadium before. It was cool. I went with family in 2014, just on a family holiday, and we went to a game. I can't remember who it was against, but it was a fairly empty, a massive ground, fairly empty. But what I did like was that there was quite a big gap between the kind of the fans and the pitch, which I wouldn't normally like, but in the gap were barbecues.
Oh, wow.
And so you just walk down to the front of the stand, and not loads, like one or two, but you'd walk down to the front of the stand and say, can I have a sausage? And then walk away with your hot dog and off you go. It was lovely.
That's great, that.
Many of my family holidays, kind of when I was younger, my memories are centered around sausages, which are probably my favourite food. So Hamburg, I was desperate to go to Free Night to draw Shakhtar Donetsk because we were playing in Hamburg. Oh, well, Shakhtar were playing in Hamburg. Hamburg is one of my favourite cities in Europe. Amazing place called Miniature Wunderland, which is the largest model railway in the world. And it's not for like nerds. I think it's the number one tourist attraction in Germany. It's incredible.
So you remember when I went to watch Dortmund a few months ago?
Yeah.
I was there on a work trip, and me and a mate from work went to a Dortmund game, and everyone else went to Miniature Wunderland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from like
interesting
in Bavaria, which is like
miles
a very
away,
long way away from Hamburg.
Yeah.
Went all the way up to Hamburg to see the
you. I think you prioritised correctly, but if you can go to Miniature Wunderland one day, then do. It's across like three floors, and you've got the Grand Canyon, the Colosseum, the Hamburg Stadium with like 60,000 individually painted,
don't they? They've got like planes taken off and stuff. Yeah,
planes taken off, and I wasn't really a Star Wars kid, but I'm pretty sure the Death Star lands at some point, which some people will find very cool.
Also, on the topic of good food and beverage situations at stadiums, you mentioned the Copenhagen one at Dortmund. I mean, this is not that common, not that uncommon in the States at other sport games, but I've not seen it in England before. They had like roving like beer dispensers. They're just like people walking around with like the massive sort of dispensers of beer on the back to save you having to go into the bar.
That would be good.
It was a great, great idea.
I'm pretty sure in the Old Trafford family stand, they tried roving food. Refreshment sellers.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that happened not that recently, quite a while ago. Maybe some of our listeners will remember that if they were sat there during that point. And there was a game last season, I can't remember which game it was, where the equivalent of that, the Man United, the very modern Man United equivalent of that happened when the card machines broke. And so they had to give they didn't have to, but they basically just gave the food out for free because there's nothing else they could do with it. So all these rollover hot dogs. And I can't remember which, it was either last season before, and these hot dogs were just flying around in the Red Army section. It was, good laugh. The game can't have been very good for that to have been the highlight.
Well, it could have been in the Ranić season by the sounds of it.
That sounds about right. The reason I brought up Hamburg is because we went on a family holiday there. Oh, me, my brother, my dad went, and we were hoping to see Hamburg or St. Pauli play, but I've been to Hamburg twice, and both times the fixtures have fucked me over and I've not been able to go. So we only went to Miniature Wunderland on both occasions. But the first time, we were there for 3 days, so 9 meals, and I had bratwurst for 9 consecutive meals. Because it was great. And the one, the food, now on a serious tangent, but the food situation I really remember, or drinks, is very long time listeners of the podcast remember that I went traveling in South America for 3 months or a little over 3 months in 2019. And one of the games I went to out of many, because that's mainly what I spent my time doing, and it was brilliant, was the strongest against Always Ready in La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, which is like 3,500 meters above sea level. When Argentina and Messi come, the Argentinian team take a cocktail of Viagra and caffeine and something else, just to try and stave off the effects of altitude sickness. It's mad. Like, you walk up the street and you're just knackered and out of breath. But these lads play football and it's incredible. And I remember I was, the second half, I was sat with kind of the very small, not ultras, but kind of dedicated fan section who were making a lot of noise. And in the first half, I was in the second tier in this massive ground, the Hernando Siles Stadium, I think it's called. And this really old guy, like creaking knees, was working his way up the steps of this fairly sparsely occupied second tier, freezing, 9 degrees. I'd just come from the Colombian Caribbean coast and I was suddenly like having this crisis of why have I come to this cold place when I've just been sunning on a beach in Colombia. And this old guy in a white scientist jacket, which was, I mean, he looked great, but it was slightly strange, was working his way up with his creaking knees using what looked like a petrol canister to kind of hoist himself up each step. And he came up and he said, I can't remember what he said. He probably said cafe, cafe. But he actually also had hot chocolate, which is what I really needed at that point. And so out of his kind of petrol canister looking canister thing, poured me a lovely cup of hot chocolate. And then he sat having a little rest for about a minute after his long way up the steps and then went about his business. And I had a great, I can't even remember what it was called, great kind of meat sandwich outside the ground as well. So, yeah, that's a serious tangent. Tony Ryan, thank you for getting us onto it. There is actually...
from Champions League predictions to that.
Yeah. There is actually a similar question on a similar theme from Ethan, who's been a patron for well over a year now, since May 2022. He says... Harry, what are your thoughts on the latest news of the Red Army section not going ahead for the Crystal Palace Cup game and potentially Galatasaray games too? Clearly seems to be a bit of tension between the Red Army and the club following an incident against Reading last season. Could be concerning long and short term, as having no atmosphere against Galatasaray is going to be an issue. So in short, the Red Army section is where I sit at Old Trafford above the tunnel and on the right side of the Stretford end. It's designed for season ticket holders primarily, but also members, but because of the way the club operates things, it normally has to be season ticket holders to apply on a game by game basis and effectively go and sit with your mates and contribute to the atmosphere. It's designed for that. It now has safe standing in the section. There's loads more context to it. There is a lot of tension between the people voluntarily organising that and dedicating loads of time to it and the club. This latest issue, there was one boycotted game last season, not where people didn't go to the game at all, but where the section didn't run, which was as a result of basically the Red Army have a section in the Stretford End right side. They would also like a section in A stand, which is right next to the away fans, because it generates a better atmosphere, gets the away fans going. There's a bit of back and forth between them. The club, the council, Great Manchester Police and a few, and like the safety and grounds authorities and whatever, are hesitant towards that for some understandable reasons, but not ones that are generally proved correct. And we're yet to hear full details on why the Red Army section won't run against Palace and Galatasaray, but I would imagine it'll be something to do with that, that the club won't let them have A stand as well, which is one of the key long-term aims for the Red Army group. So yeah, it's a real shame. As someone who sits or stands in there every week, the times where you don't get to stand in there are so much worse. The atmosphere in other parts of Old Trafford can be terrible. The group's done so much good work and really changed the way I approach home games. And even in the sense of, I used to be desperate to go on domestic away games, and that would be kind of the highlight of any season, when actually the atmosphere at most home games now is better than most domestic away games, where too many... tickets are landing in the so-called wrong hands. So it's a real shame. And yeah, Ethan, you're right. Galatasaray is going to be certainly an issue. Palace as well. They'll fill their section in the League Cup, I would imagine. They'll get 9,000 or something and they will drown United out because there won't be a loud section in Stretford End. So yeah, it's definitely a problem. Jack, do you want me to give you some multiple choice questions for the quiz question I gave you earlier, which was, outside of the UK and Ireland, from which country have United had the most players? Or you can give me your thoughts if you like, just in general.
Yeah, I've been trying to kind of rack my brains. United have a long history of Scandinavian players, but mainly from Denmark and Norway off the top of my head. But I just don't know if it'd be enough to put them that high up France and Portugal are also coming to mind. I don't think we've had that many Spaniards over the years. I think we've had a few recently in the last like 5 or 10 years. I mean, France, I feel
while
like
you're saying this, I'm just trying to write, I'm just trying to find the piece of paper where I wrote the answer down.
France is the obvious.
I can give you, let me give you the multiple, because you've mentioned a few of them.
Yeah, go on.
The multiple choice answers are Denmark, France, or the Netherlands.
Oh, Netherlands is a good one. I forgot about that.
I can't find the piece of paper right now. I think I know the answer, but I don't want to give the wrong one. So we'll delay a little
just
bit.
Just say that whichever one I say is right.
No. I'll let you have a little bit longer to mull it over while I remind myself of what definitely the answer is and how many players there were. And then, yeah, for now, we'll move on.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Marek Garbowski, who has been a patron for an incredible 3 years since October 2020. Marek, thank you for your long-time support. He says, and this will be probably the last question for this episode, and then we'll have another one later in the week. Marek says, let's look into the future. Let's say Erik ten Hag continues as manager for another 5 years. The club, unfortunately, remains in the hands of the Glazers. We have managed to improve our recruitment. Hard to believe this is going to happen, he says. And players who should go are gone. Taking this hypothetical scenario into account, how do you see our position as a club in the Premier League and European competitions? Is Old Trafford going to look exactly as it looks, or will there be a change? What style of football are we going to play? Do you have even a tiny dose of hope of winning a meaningful title by 2028? Big one, Jack. So, Ten Hag's been manager for 5 years. United should have won a title, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, what percentage chance would you give of Ten Hag being here if we haven't won a title by 2028? I think mine would be 10.
Yeah, maybe 10 to 15. I think the only way he's still here 5 years from now, if we haven't won the league, is if we've won multiple cups, we've come very close in the league, probably on more than one occasion,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Like if it was like we came really close in 2025 and then we haven't since, he won't still be here. But if we'd have, say like we had Arsenal's season last year,
twice.
If we had that season in 2026 and 2027, I could see him still being there.
Yeah.
If you've also picked up a couple of FA Cups, maybe a deep Champions League run as well, I think he could still be there under those circumstances.
Yeah, and I'd still give a 10% because of what that requires, given the rest of the question. It's basically saying if things carry on as they are now, but with a bit better improvement, what style of football are we going to play? I guess closer to Ten Hag's Ajax once he's had 5 years. Is Old Trafford going to look the same? Yeah, pretty much. If the Glazers stay beyond this period, and that's what the hypothetical includes, the plans around the Old Trafford, kind of what the club was looking at, the Old Trafford refurbishment or rebuild option, did involve building work around 2028. So Marek's asking about 2028. At that point, if the Glazers are here, this is all quite hard to imagine, but you would expect something to be going on with Old Trafford. If the Glazers are here, they will have got some outside investment from an injection of capital from some kind of thing like Elliott Investment or whoever, which would have to pay for the investment into a new ground. So yeah, it's really hard to answer this. Because I just can't see it happening. It's so hard to stay as United manager for that long anyway. Not many people have managed it, even between Busby and Ferguson, even before that. So it's really difficult. Let's answer the bigger question. Do you have hope of winning a meaningful title by 2028? I do, yes. Because ultimately, it'd be quite hard to drag myself to 40 or 50 games a season.
There's always hope. Like, I don't, you could have asked me this every year since we've been doing this podcast back to like 2016. If you'd have asked the same question, do you have hope that in the next five years, we might win a title? The answer probably would have been yes. We're 7 years from that now. We've never really been close, but that hope always has to remain, I think. I mean, do I think it's likely? No, but I think there's always hope, isn't there? There's got to be.
Yeah. And I have hope on the Ten Hag. I don't think United can win a title with the Glazers' ownership. But I think United can win a Champions League.
I'm actually not sure I agree with that.
Which
honestly,
bit?
That we can't win the league under the Glazers.
Why?
I think we could, but I think it makes it incredibly more difficult. But
You're basically relying on all the other clubs. Bear in mind, two are currently owned by nation states.
Yeah.
Two fail, which has happened in one season, the Leicester City season, but that didn't involve Saudi Arabia, Newcastle. Football was different anyway. Arsenal have had massive investment. Liverpool were in an all right place, and the Pep Guardiola juggernaut hadn't begun.
I think it would require two or three transfer windows in a row where 75% of all of United signings are massive successes. Now, do I think that that is feasible? Realistically, probably not. But if that happened, then yeah, I think United could win the title under the Glazers. But I think the chances of that happening under the Glazers is much, much less than it would be under any other kind of ownership.
The problem is, it's not that I don't think any club can win with this ownership structure. I oppose this ownership structure at any club. But it doesn't mean I don't think they can win. And United showed that from 2005 to 2013. But the examples are so big now, or so defining and detailed from every season of the last 18, that I have no faith that United can win the title. The Premier League title's now probably the hardest thing to win in Europe. Well, in world football. Yeah. So you need to be the best club in the world to win it.
It would require other clubs to come back to us as well. Something I always talk about, like let's look at points, the amount of points you get rather than where you actually finish. In the last 5 or 6 years, it's generally taken 95 points at least to win the league. I can't see United ever getting there under the Glazers. To your point, that is the kind of ceiling that I don't think is possible under this kind of ownership.
Yeah, look at who's won titles recently. City, which for 8 years, even before Pep Guardiola came, everything was designed and built, not just kind of the virtual infrastructure, but the physical infrastructure was designed specifically for Pep Guardiola to become manager. And then everything's ended up being almost perfect. Surprise, surprise. Liverpool, who are kind of the closest as a club structure under a talismanic manager, with an incredible recruitment team, are the closest non-nation state thing that has come to kind of recent footballing perfection across the club. And even then, they won one title and one Champions League.
I think if you ask me, can Man United under the Glazers become like a 9,500 point a season team? No, because it has to, as you're pointing out with Guardiola, it has to be in a scenario where every single part of the club is built around basically bringing in the players that manager wants, with and backing that manager's decisions, which isn't going to happen to the extent it would need to for United to get to that level. If winning the title went back to how it was, let's say 8, 9, 10 years ago, where it requires 85 to 90 points, yeah, I think United could get there under Ten Hag with the Glazers owning the club. I mean, we got 81 under Mourinho is our best points total post Sir Alex. I think, what did we end up on last year? About 75?
Stop paying attention to the league table near the end.
It was something like that. I think I said at the start of the season that United should be aiming for 80 points this season. I think you could get to 88, 89 under Ten Hag, but that's probably the very maximum if everything goes really well. And so for that to be able to win the league, it's going to require City, Liverpool, maybe Arsenal to fall back.
You basically need all of the current top. You basically need Newcastle to delay Newcastle's rise, kind of inevitable rise, to be delayed. And in that time, Guardiola, Klopp and Arteta to leave Arsenal.
Possibly.
And the chances of that are, yeah. I know what you mean. There is a chance. If Ten Hag is the one, then he can overcome those things. But there have been two the ones in United history, and they're hard to come by. And they're normally from Scotland. We'll see. Marek's other question, which is related, is if we finish outside the top four this season, how many years do you realistically give Ten Hag to continue before his kind of before that's it? That's kind of what we've been saying. He needs to stave off basically the pressure, and you do that by winning trophies. He's won one. I think he could get away with a trophyless season this year if there's obvious signs of progress, but then he would require one next year.
I think he'd probably survive if we finished fifth and we were close to getting top four. But the start of next year, he'd be under serious pressure.
I think given the off-pitch matters this year, next season would have to start well. But I think, certainly from a fan perspective, people would understand that. And I think people inside the club as well. There's a lot of faith in Ten Hag. He's doing really good things. And yeah, I'm willing to be very patient with him. And as we said last week, the uptick you get from replacing a manager is so often short term. United need to go through a bit of pain with someone who's clearly a really talented coach and see where it gets us. Final question for this first episode of the Patreon mailbag out of the pairing is from Paul Meacham, who is our latest member of Manchester United Weekly Podcast Patreon community. He joined just a couple of weeks ago. Paul says, I've been bumping into gooners everywhere this week. So have I, because I've been staying at my parents down in North London. He says, even on my bloody dog walk, still find myself annoyed by last weekend. Not sure why it's bothered me so much compared to other games which had more at stake. So, in an attempt to ask a question that is at the other end of the importance scale, what's your opinion on United's three kits this season? For me, I think the home kit's solid. Hate the green away kit, and think the third white kit is the best of the lot. Love the new logo. Shame the Team Viewer logo is so big and clunky. I would go home third, away as my ranking.
Like home
of the
being
three.
The best.
Yeah. I think the home's brilliant.
My only thing with the home kit is I'm not sure about the black touches on it. I think United should be red and white, but I do like the design of it in general.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I don't mind them.
I think the white away kit is great. I've got to say, the away kit would still be my third of those three. I don't dislike it as much as everyone else does. I think it looks all right.
I disliked it a lot when it came out. Having seen it in person, it's a lot less bad than it seemed. I still don't
the
love
replica.
It.
Do you remember when it first came out? The replica versions, they are terrible.
Yeah.
When it's
but
like
even those I've seen like in public and think not too bad.
They're not as bad.
No. As Paul says, I don't think you really value a kit until a few years later, which may also depend on if you associate it with any success, which is absolutely true. I think last season's kit was great.
I hate any United kit with a Chevrolet sponsor on it now for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Although there weren't many good kits then anyway. That was a really bad.
No, there weren't.
There were a couple of nice away ones. There was that nice blue, a couple of nice blue away kits. That's a real shame. I think United need more blue away kits, and in the last few years we haven't had them. Yeah. I have an answer for you. So give me a final guess, please. Outside of the UK and Ireland, from which country have United had the most players?
So I'm gonna go with the one that I didn't actually think of initially. I'm gonna go with the Netherlands.
And you'd be spot on. The Netherlands, 15, France, 13, Denmark, 7, Portugal, Spain, and Sweden, which I think a few years ago wouldn't have been even in the discussion. Always 6 coming in a joint fourth place. Right. My dog is going off. And I think that's a sign for me to take him out now for us to wrap up this first Patreon mailbag question. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you, patrons, for your questions. Some nice ones in there. In the second episode of this, we're going to talk about Anthony, social media, patience, our favourite United memories, an all-time 11, first games at Old Trafford, how we became a United fan, the difference between United fans in Manchester, the rest of England, and, for example, the USA, the rest of the world. We're going to talk about Jude Bellingham at Real Madrid, Messi, loads of stuff. So that one should be very good as well. Thank you for listening, everyone. And we'll see you in just a couple of days. And my dog's saying goodbye as well. So goodbye from me, goodbye from Jack, and goodbye from Sam the dog. See you soon.
Social Podcast Network.